You're listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. This episode features the fourth and final installment of Visions of Courage, the second year of our Women's History Lecture Series, presented by historian Jill Zahneiser. You can listen to all of these episodes on thefriends.org/podcast or on iTunes. Jill Zahneiser is an independent scholar who holds a PhD from the University of Iowa. She has taught at the Universities of Iowa and Minnesota, St. Cloud State University, and the University of Wisconsin-River Falls. Dr. Zahneiser is the co-author of the recent book, Alice Paul Claiming Power, and the author of the And Then She Said series of quotations by women. In this episode, Professor Zahneiser discusses how Mexican women helped shape their expatriate communities in Minnesota from the mid-20th century onward. We discover the important ways they fought for respect and equal treatment in the Twin Cities and in Greater Minnesota. Throughout the presentation, Professor Zahneiser refers to a series of visuals included in a PowerPoint presentation. This presentation and a suggested reading list is available to view on thefriends.org/courage. We encourage you to download these visuals before listening. Thank you for listening to Friendly Connections. Without any further ado, here's the fourth and final episode of Visions of Courage.
Thank you, Bailey. We are at the end of our 4.4 part series tonight, so I want to thank the Friends for being willing to sponsor this 2 years in a row. I was just talking to Bailey about the possibility of a third series, and it looks like the Friends are interested in doing that, maybe not in the fall next year, but perhaps in the spring. I was saying to Bailey, we haven't talked about Amelia Earhart yet, who has a local connection, so that might be one talk that we schedule next year. We were talking last time, we were talking about the history of the women's movement. We've been talking about that the last couple times. I happened to be watching a late night television last week, and we had mentioned last week the famous protest against the 1968 Miss America pageant, if you remember. And one of the late night shows, James Corden, came out and commented that he had noticed that the Miss America pageant was on recently, and he was amazed, being an enlightened gentleman, he was amazed to find out that in America, because he's British, we're still doing that. And he mentioned that to one of his friends, and his friend said, well, don't you do a Miss United Kingdom? And he said, yes, we do. Miss United Kingdom is Queen Elizabeth, and she wins every year. So I thought that was rather good. But evidence, just his comment, evidence of the changing attitude there. Tonight, we're going to talk about Mexican women, the history of Mexican women in Minnesota. And we might have to talk first a little bit about terminology. A lot of us are used to the term Hispanic, which some people find offensive because it really eliminates the distinctions between people from Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, other Spanish-speaking nations. And although all of these people share a language, although not necessarily a dialect, and they may share aspects of culture, they do not share a particular history. So in my research, Mexicans want to show pride in their own culture. They prefer the term Mexicana for women, Mexican for the men, or Mexicano, or more recently, and we'll talk about the more recent activism, Chicana or Chicano. So I'll be using those terms tonight. Historically, in Mexican culture, women are seen, and this has some similarity with some of the Muslim cultures, really. Women have been seen as having kind of a dangerous potential. And for this reason, there is a need to contain them, speaking historically again. Men's reputation has been tied to men's authority in the household, and women's place, as in this country, of course, seen in the home. We don't have quite that dangerous potential aspect to American culture as in Mexican culture and to some extent in Muslim culture. Maternity for Mexican women is really seen, has been seen historically, as a tremendous source of women's self-respect and also pride. that this is their way of contributing to the culture, obviously the continuation of the culture. Obviously, these things have changed both in Mexico and also as Mexicans have come into the U.S., as the U.S. is changing its ideas about what women and men are as well. And we'll talk about some of those changes. So Mexicans have a distinct profile in the Midwest. To some degree, their history in Minnesota and in other Midwest cities is like that of other European immigrants in some ways, in the sense that they came here either seeking refuge when there were disruptive times in Mexico, or they came here seeking work. So in that respect, they're like other European immigrants. Mexicans coming to the Midwest were immigrants, unlike in Texas, in the Southwest states, where essentially they functioned in a very different way, because these were areas that Mexico had once held, or Spain had once held. Mexicans really were a conquered people in that area. And so when you look at histories of Mexicans in the Southwest and in the Midwest, there are some distinct differences in that sense. So they're really more truly immigrants in this area. But for many years, everyone thought of, had this idea that anyone who appeared to be Mexican was here as a migrant worker and they were going home again when they were done working. That seldom has been true, although certainly people have gone back and forth. More recently, you know, when we think of Mexicans, we think of everyone as coming from Mexico as opposed to someone, say, who was born in Texas, whose parents were born in Mexico and who ended up in Minnesota. So we have the people that have come to Minnesota have sometimes been from Mexico, but also sometimes have been from Texas and from the Southwest areas. And they're all sort of grouped together as Mexicans. A significant number of people coming here moved north in search of work from Texas, from Oklahoma particularly, sometimes from the Southwest. They often have become invisible when we talk about immigrants. We talk these days, we're more interested in Hmong immigrants, we're more interested in African immigrants. We have the stereotype still of Mexicans as all illegal, which they certainly aren't, and as to some extent invisible because there are groups that we think of as more important. One of the other differences in perhaps the way we think about Mexicans coming to Minnesota is that for the most part there has always been a balanced gender ratio, about as many men as women, except for the very beginning, as we'll talk about. And that's because most people, either coming from the south of the United States or from Mexico, did come for agricultural work initially. And the agricultural work was family work. And so not only the husband was working, but the wife and the children. These were family wages. So there's always been a fairly balanced gender ratio in this area, unlike other areas where you have a lot of young adult males coming and perhaps going back or going to other areas for work when the work dries up in this area. So that's not true. And we see here an image, one of the very hard to find really early images from Minnesota, but this is a mother and child, 1925. In Minnesota. And you can see the very, very traditional dress at that time. So as noted, when do you think the earliest person recorded who was Mexican came to Minnesota, or stayed in Minnesota, I should say? When do you think the earliest? Well, this is Gilbert de la O, an esteemed member of the Mexican-American community. So he knows more than most. But that's right, 1886, and his name was Luis Garzon. He actually, and this may surprise you too, he was touring with the Mexico City Orchestra in 1886. He came to Minneapolis to tour. He became ill, and ill enough that he needed to stay here, and the rest of the orchestra went without him. And I was not able to find out whether he stayed. Do you know? He did stay. So that is the first recorded. But the first any significant numbers of Mexicans came before the Mexican Revolution, which starts about 1910, but came to work on the railroads. Mexican men had built a railroad in Mexico, and when the United States was trying to make connections with Mexico. They used Mexican workers at times, and then they recruited Mexican workers to help building some of the ancillary railroads in this country. So the first workers that we have, people coming beyond Luis, about pre-1910, this is a little bit later, people in Illinois, but typical, these are young men who are willing to travel around for work, and they come into the Midwest for railroad work. Not a lot of people, and they're not really staying, they're moving around for different kinds of work. The big disruption that brings a lot of people north happens between 1910 and 1920, the Mexican Revolution, which was just tremendous disruption in Mexico for about 10 years. And as we're seeing now in other parts of the world, this gets people to leave and look for more peaceful territories, more peaceful circumstances, and work typically dries up in these periods. So people are looking for new ways to support themselves and are willing to leave their homes in order to not only protect themselves, but find a way to support themselves. And so we find people coming forward because of the Mexican Revolution. That was the push factor. When we're talking about immigration, we always have the push factors, things that are getting people to leave their country, and then we have the pull factors. Well, the pull factors in Minnesota is that agricultural workers or employers were interested in using Mexican families to do agricultural work, particularly sugar beet employers. If you don't know what a sugar beet is, I had to look this up myself, it's a particular kind of beet that is processed to make sugar. It's a lot easier to process for granulated sugar, white sugar, than sugar cane is. So this became quite a large industry in Minnesota, and it is the sugar beet employers who first recruit Mexicans to Minnesota, Mexican families. So there are really three industries that become key in these early years. First, it's the railroads, then it's the sugar beet employers, and then later, as we have some Mexicans in the urban areas like St. Paul, and St. Paul becomes the most important, it's packing house work. So it's the sugar beet workers that brings families here. And at that time, coming across the border was nothing like it is today. In our lifetimes, it's gotten progressively more complicated coming across any border. But at that time, if you could indicate that you had work, you were coming for work, the idea of someone coming into the country was more slanted towards what American employers needed rather than who it was that was coming in. So it was very easy to get across. And there are a number of oral histories that have been done, taking histories from people who came really in the very early years. The histories were done in the mid-70s, and they are online at the Minnesota Historical Society website. They have the transcripts, most of which are in English, and they also have the recording. So if you're interested in listening to any of these people's stories, just go to the Minnesota Historical Society website. I will be using a few of those just as examples tonight. So it was very easy to come across the border. Speaking of those interviews, a gentleman named Luis Medina, who was interviewed in 1975, talked about his particular story. He said that during the Mexican Revolution, his father had already gone to the U.S. to seek work. He was working in Arkansas, I believe, at that time. And so his mother, the historical profile of women is, oh, they're in the home and they're under the authority of the male. Well, here's not an uncommon situation where the father had already gone to the U.S. and who was taking care of everybody? It's the mother. So the mother is assuming authority and assuming power in that situation. His mother decided to leave. He had two other brothers. He was 6 years old. And the mother took the family, wanted to go across to Laredo, Texas. They decided because Luis could not see very well. And apparently they decided that if he couldn't see very well, he couldn't work very well. And so he's 6 years old. And they decided he was not going to come across, amazingly enough. So he was separated from his family. He's left with people he really didn't know, very upset about it, obviously. And finally, he finds sort of a friendly person who helps him essentially come across the border without encountering these agents that he had encountered before. So he reunites with his family. They start in Laredo, then they go to San Antonio, they go to Oklahoma, Indiana, Oklahoma again, Arkansas, seeking work for the family. Finally, they reconnected with the father and a sister and worked the cotton fields in the southern part of the U.S. The father gets sick in Kansas City when they're living there. This is 1925, finally. The parents separate again. Father dies a year later. And a couple years later, the mother decides, has heard that there are jobs in Minnesota, and so she comes with the children to Owatonna, down in the south, to pick sugar beets. So this is a good example of, first of all, how complicated the journey might be, and secondly, how much authority and power women might assume in certain circumstances. So that's Luis Medina's story. He goes on to say that after working sugar beets for several years in Owatonna, he found somebody he wanted to marry. She married him against her parents' wishes. So another example of women sort of taking their own power. And they moved to St. Paul, where he finds work on the streetcars and on the railroads during the winter. But every year they go back to the fields until 1935 to pick sugar beets so that they can have steady year-round employment. So this was also very common to go back and forth because a lot of the companies would lay people off in the summer. Even in St. Paul, his income was not enough, and his wife, even though he didn't particularly want his wife to work, that the ideal was that the married woman would stay at home, as in a lot of cultures. His wife, sometimes when they didn't have enough, she went out and found part-time work in St. Paul. Finally, he secured a meatpacking job. The packing house is down, that used to be down there along Concord Street. And after that time, his pay was not great, but it was good enough that she no longer worked. He commented, though, in 1975, all his children, of course, born in Minnesota, he commented that he considered his children to be Mexican, and he wanted them to be very proud of their Mexican culture. So that's one example. And as I mentioned, meatpacking, the third industry that's very important in terms of Mexican history here in Minnesota. So many people coming north, finding agricultural work, and women are a key part of this because it is family work. The women are not paid as much. Nobody's paid very much, even the men. Women make about a third less, and the children make even less than that. But it's a family wage, which, again, for some of the European immigrant groups, very common that nobody makes very much, but if you put several not very muches together, you can maybe make it. By 1927, 26 and 27, the East Grand Forks area, the Red River Valley, where there are a lot of sugar beet farms, and the southern Minnesota, Owatonna, Albert Lea, has the largest rural population of Mexicans. And again, with a fairly balanced gender ratio, there were 7,000 Mexicans, either from the Texas Southwest area or born in Mexico, in Minnesota by 1928. Not too many of them are urban. In that same period of time, Minneapolis has only about 125 Mexicans, and St. Paul has about 467. So because of the packing houses and the important employment with that, St. Paul, and particularly the west side, and what was then called, what Gilbert referred to as the flats, which we're now redeveloping, become the area where Mexicans settle on the west. And we'll talk about the elimination of that later on. In St. Paul, the gender ratio is a little heavily in favor of men because of the number of men employed in the packing industry. So a little bit unbalanced. In Minneapolis, it's about even. The West Side's flats were quickly considered sort of the worst slum, really, in town. Terrible conditions there. And the assumption was these people are not staying very long, and so why do they need good housing? But the outdoor privies there, very few people had water. They were using fire hydrants if they were available. That area, as you maybe know, if you've lived in St. Paul at all, is routinely flooded. Not so much anymore, but was routinely flooded in those days, that flat area around the airport and just south of downtown. Initially, people coming north for the harvest, for a number of years, employers were willing, rather than pay for them to travel back either to Texas, somewhere in the south, or into Mexico, they were willing to put up essentially shacks or to use discarded boxcars, if you can believe it, from the railroad to house people year-round so that because it was cheaper initially than having them travel back and forth from the south and then back up. They were housed in essentially terrible conditions. And then, of course, the employers would sort of give them an advance on the next year's wages so that they could make it through the winter. And then, you know, they're in a worse situation come spring. So that was their situation initially. Then, and they're at the mercy of the employers, most employers decide that it's easier to tell people to go into the cities during the winter, ostensibly to find work, so that they don't have to take the expense of housing them during the winter. A lot of people decided they didn't want to bother with the shacks that the people were living in. So we see more people doing that, going back and forth as the Medinas did. Some, of course, are going elsewhere to work. And this woman, sugar beet work is a little bit later than this, but typical woman working in the fields at that time for the sugar beet. This is an example, and it's a bit later than this, but this discarded boxcar was made into a chapel at one point. This is 1949 in the St. Paul area. But if you can imagine family living in something like this, and this is probably a lot better looking than most of them looked in the late 20s or the early 1930s. And so we have, because people are either don't have the money to travel south or don't have any other work possibilities, they come to St. Paul, Minneapolis, but St. Paul begins to have the largest concentration in an urban area, and most of that on the west side. People had these stereotypes about Mexicans as being lazy, as being shiftless, as being impossible to assimilate into the American population. Some of these, of course, are still with us. But somewhat ironically, the area of the barrio on the west side had the lowest crime rate in the city. So those two things don't quite match up. The community was a very tight community. The family was considered sort of the basic unit, and the unit with authority over obviously the children, other folks. And there was a lot of self-help going on and a lot of self-policing. And so this is why that was able to make sense. And as I mentioned, many people lived in these discarded boxcars on the flats until there was some other housing built. One gentleman who grew up on the West Side flats, Romero Saucedo, he said, "We just didn't think there was such a thing as stealing. This was pounded into our heads when we were small." So there was a lot of parental authority here in terms of paying attention to the Ten Commandments, many of them very religious people, Catholic, and you know, strictly policing themselves as to do the right thing, on the other hand, to keep people who felt negatively about them out of the community as well. As we get more Mexicans in this area of the West Side Flats, we begin to see some attention to them in the guise of social workers. The Settlement House movement began with Jane Addams in this country, founding Hull House in the late 19th century. It comes to St. Paul beginning in 1897, founded by Jews in order to help the people who were then living on the West Side Flats, who were Russian Jews, who had emigrated to Minnesota. By 1923, they are deciding that there is a quote-unquote Mexican problem, because a lot of the Russian Jews had moved on and out into other areas of the city, had done some assimilating, and they had more and more Mexicans essentially taking up this area of the West Side Flats. So people at the neighborhood house, still with us, not in this building. They got a new building in 1924, and this is it. It was on Indiana Street, which I don't believe is any longer with us. But this was essentially the settlement house here in the mid-20s, the neighborhood house. And they are essentially, like all settlement houses, attempting to assist with Americanizing people. And this could take a sort of positive aspect of encouraging social activities, and it could take a negative aspect of sort of pushing people to accept American culture and discard the values that they had grown up with. And as with all immigrant groups, we see them making their own decisions about how much they wish to be Americanized. We see a lot of sort of entrepreneurial impulse on part of some people in the Mexican community in initiating their own community activities, with getting the help of people at the neighborhood house, trying to own some of what's going on at the neighborhood house themselves. A woman named Zamora, Mrs. Zamora, started a Christmas play that the young people were engaged with. And this was something that was their activity, and they were creating it themselves, and it was for their own community. So one example, and this is a good example, her activities of how married women, even though they weren't working, they're also seen in Mexican culture as sort of the bearers of the culture. They need to carry forth the culture, not only by having children, but by teaching culture. And so we have married women who were not working, or not working then, going into the community when we begin to have these self-help places in the neighborhood house, creating things like the Christmas tree, creating things like the Mexican Independence Day celebration. So creating cultural activities for their own community and by their own community as a way of sort of owning their own experience. And she was one of the people that did that. So this is another way there are married women particularly are assuming some authority. In the 1930s, a place called the International Institute is formed out of the YWCA. Got it. And they're a little more progressive in their outlook, very similar activities. And we see here an English class at the International Institute in 1937. Again, we see a lot of self-help activity and a beginning of founding now that people had decided they were there to stay, particularly people who were no longer going back and forth to the fields every summer. We begin to see community institutions like Our Lady of Guadalupe, still there on the west side, founded by Mexican immigrants in 1931. I was asking Judy Rangel, whose name in Mexico, I guess, is Rangel. Her husband's name is a very common name when you read histories of the Mexican community here. And a gentleman by the name of Francisco Rangel became, because there was no Mexican consulate here, as there was in other cities with a larger Mexican population, he became a volunteer who promoted Mexican culture and Mexican social values for the local community. And so that was an effort on the part of the home country, Mexico, to try to maintain the Mexican culture in the midst of people leaving the country. And there's another organization that was founded at that time, and since I don't speak Spanish, I'm going to ruin this pronunciation, Sociedad Ana Anahuac, which was, again, a self-help community organization which had a specific women's auxiliary that was very active in the kinds of activities that I mentioned before. Francisco's wife, Cresenia, is one of the people that was interviewed by the Historical Society. She was born in Mexico City, married there in 1921. Because she had an aunt who was in Kansas, she managed to pay to come across in 1930 to visit her aunt. She expected to go back to Mexico, but unfortunately she lost all of her money. Her money was stolen. So she was stuck in Kansas, and you don't want to be stuck in Kansas. Fortunately, she had a brother in Minnesota who wrote her that there was work available, and so she took the train to Mexico and with her husband, and her husband was able to get a job in one of the packing houses. And he worked then, although he was laid off at times, he worked for the packing industry for 25 years. She talks about working when her husband was laid off. So he was laid off and wasn't bringing in, she found a way, whether it was working as a domestic, working as a seamstress, those were the common things that were available, the only things available to Mexican women. She joined the International Institute, became very active, and when she was not working, she was the person who took charge of, one of the people who took charge of showcasing traditional Mexican food and also Mexican music. So she, again, created that space for a Mexican community within the International Institute. So Mexican women are not only homemakers, but they are working periodically as needed. They are working in the fields, people that are working out in the rural areas, this family economy. So the ideal didn't exactly match the reality of what was necessary. And anytime someone is contributing to the income and the sustenance of a house, that person assumes more authority and more power in the house. So this is some of what was happening and was really contradicting the traditional values of Mexico at the same time that views in American culture about women were changing. And that was one way in which we see some Mexican women, at least, embracing American values in that way. Another common pattern, if the married woman did not want to work or did not have any opportunities, this idea of the family economy could also hold sway in urban areas if there were opportunities for the daughter to work as a seamstress, as a servant in someone's house when people had servants. There weren't a lot of opportunities open. They were typically menial. Again, the stereotypes about Mexicans did not consider them to be worthy of or educated enough to do other kinds of work. But the daughter and the son could also contribute to that family economy at times. And even after people acquired language skills, the English language, these kinds of stereotypes still abided. We come to the Depression, and this, so we could kind of compare it to what's been going on in the last 10 or 15 years here today. When you have people who are born in America who all of a sudden find that work is scarce, then we start blaming other people. We start pointing our finger at somebody. And so we find during the Depression era, when a lot of people were out of work, just as we found as opportunities and wages have been sort of stuck for many Americans in our own time, we begin to look for people to blame for it. And so we see, even though in previous years we've had employers encouraging Mexicans, either from Texas or Mexico, to come north, now we want to send them back because they are supposedly taking jobs from other people. So we have some repatriation measures in the Depression era, and a real reluctance, this sense, some of the reports from the oral histories, that on the one hand, people complimented us because we were a very tight community and we were helping each other. But then they used that as an excuse for not granting us relief. So there were a lot of those kinds of things going on in terms of Mexican families making it during the Depression. We do see more people coming into the urban areas during this time, however. One of those people is Marcelina Urvina, who was born in Texas in 1918. So she's an American from the beginning, a Mexican American. She says she said her mother was a widow. Her oldest brother and her sister, Jesusita, stayed in Texas while the rest of the family came to work in the beet fields. And she said she was 12 when they came under contract. They're coming here because somebody wants them here to work in Mankato. She said her mother thought we could make more money by having the whole family work. And they brought the whole family in a train. They were housed there, and then they would go to different farms in the Mankato area. So her mother and five children were working on a farm in St. Clair. She was 12. They had 25 acres that they were supposed to work. And she said she worked the sugar beets until she was 16, and then she got married. This was in 1934. Unfortunately, her husband died of a heart attack after 18 months. So this points up, you know, the conditions that most Mexicans are living in, the mortality rate, life expectancy is a good deal shorter as it is today for Mexicans than it is for Native Americans. So she loses her first husband. She marries again. Her second husband was arrested and chose to go back to Mexico rather than go to jail. And she chose, even after that, to stay rather than go back to Texas, since she felt her children were born here and she wanted them to stay here. So that's just part of her story. She said that she didn't want to work or live on the farm anymore, so they came to the Twin Cities. And this is, I'm going to read you exactly what she says in her interview. But they did not want us here because they said we were not residents and that they could not help us with anything, that we would have to go back to where we came from. We did not know what to do. We went to the relief office because we did not have anything and we needed help. They did not want to help us. They came at night and put all of our things into a truck and took us back and left us there. And then we came back. My mother said that they had no right. My mother was very energetic. When she wanted to do something, she did it. She was not afraid. She did not speak English, but she could still make herself understood. We came to St. Paul at night, and she insisted we stay here so her children could go to school to learn to read and write. She did not want them to be like her, not able to read and write. She decided that we would stay here and no one would throw us out. So even though there are attempts, and again, we see very, very strong authority in terms of a Mexican. These are not shy people. So that's Marcelina Urvina's story. So a lot of people saw Mexicans as temporary residents, even though they'd been here for 20 years. And clearly, we're staying around. So we continue having these ideas about them being temporary, taking jobs from other people. In 1936, only 20% of the Mexicans that were here actually had year-round employment. The WPA, one of the New Deal programs, provided work for some women. The WPA provided some work, usually sewing again, domestic labor. Some of the people in the settlement house and International Institute, they would find someone who they thought was a willing person, and they would hire that person and sort of keep them in that position for them, sort of benefiting for themselves from available labor. Child labor laws, of course, were enforced by this time in the 30s, but they, in terms of these agricultural employment situations where families were working, child labor laws were essentially ignored on behalf of the agricultural employer. So very little impact there on Mexican families that are working. Going back to the notion of the community expanding in terms of the cultural and social activities, we see the annual celebration of Mexican Independence Day, going back to the revolution, beginning in 1938, and it's held every year after that time. And this is the Garcia family in one of the rural areas of Minnesota in the 1930s. Wartime, everybody benefits. By that time, there are about 2,500 Mexicans in St. Paul, about 3,000 by 1946, slightly after the war bringing in people because there was work. Because there was steady wartime employment in the city, so many industries ramping up, more families chose not to do the agricultural work because there was work in town, and their children did not have to work. So they were choosing to keep children in the urban areas so that they could go to school. By the 1940s, the majority of people on the West Side Flats in that area were Mexicans. Italians and the Russians had moved on. Only 13%, however, by 1946, of the Mexicans in Minnesota owned homes, and the homes that they owned were usually the worst homes, the things that they could afford. So that's for the amount of time that a lot of people had been here, that just suggests how they were sort of, that the culture was determinedly keeping them out of more lucrative employment into situations where they could move up in terms of work, in terms of home situations, like many immigrants had the opportunity to do. We don't have as many agricultural workers needed during the 40s, but there are some, especially for second generation people with English language skills. There are some new opportunities in manufacturing during the war, some sales opportunities. Women during the war were considered such important workers that not only for Mexican women, but for women in general, and this happens to be a daycare center in the West Side area, that children are given daycare for free so that the women can go to work during the war. Shortly after the war, we begin to see some of the agricultural work turning into factory work. And this is a worker photographed in 1948 at the Dolly Green Giant. So we see some of those agricultural jobs becoming, as agriculture changes, becoming jobs that are more technological. 1947 survey, Mexican women, only 52%, about half of them, reported that they were not working for pay. Because they tended to go in and out of the job market, any kind of statistic is kind of questionable because, you know, they're saying what's going on right now. But half of them were reporting they were not working for pay. 23% were unemployed, most likely women who had jobs during the war, But after the war, a lot of women, as we talked about before, were kind of pushed out because of the returning men. So 23% considered themselves unemployed, and 25% were working. This is just after World War II. With the Cold War, we begin, now that we're seeing the economy doing something different, we're finding sort of the discouragement of women, particularly in the workforce. The government sort of changes its mind about whether it wants immigrants, particularly Mexican immigrants. The 1952 Immigration Act kind of changes how we judge immigrants, and it bans people who are immoral. Interesting how you judge that. Political radicals, anyone who has done anything unlawful, rather than setting quotas, which was the way we did it before, for different countries of origin. Interesting that in 1952, President Truman actually vetoed this because he thought it was unconstitutional, but Congress overrode his veto. This was the McCarthy era, so this is the context during which this happened. So we have pushback on the idea of immigration in general. We have more second generation with children attending school, but a lot of getting a lot of negative vibes when they go to school. One of the people interviewed by the Historical Society, Luis Guzman, born in 1934, so going to high school in the 50s, talked about the fact that he was ashamed of being Mexican when he was going to school, and he did everything he could to become an American. And the kind of attitudes that he got in going to school made him feel ashamed. He later, as an adult, regretted that he felt ashamed, but of course it was too late. Still, we see Mexicans, whether it's men or women, in overwhelmingly unskilled jobs. So, you know, this is a long time after many people have come to Minnesota, and yet we don't see any real movement up as we do for other immigrants. So it's difficult not to come down to some sort of race prejudice in terms of, you know, why we're not seeing the sort of typical pattern of people that have been here a long time. So we see a lot of kids dropping out from school because they're getting such negative feedback. They're tracked often into the sort of the "we don't expect anything of you" classes, or they're actively discouraged from seeking higher education or certain kinds of jobs. Men who, and this is mostly men, who are getting involved in unions have the same experience. They're very excited about unions initially, and then they get the same attitude from unions that, oh no, we don't expect you to actually get a better job. We want to unionize you, but we want you to stay in this unskilled or semi-skilled job. So we see some discouragement in terms of Mexican participation in unions as well. The Sociedad ends in 1958 as the first generation kind of survival mechanisms give way to much more focus on the cultural and social groups. And in the late 50s, as we said, for women in general in America, we're seeing more women move into the workforce. That 23% that they were unemployed in 1948, they were looking for work. So they decided they wanted to stay in the workforce. And we see this, it doesn't quite pick up as early a time as we're talking about, but you can see, we're talking about all workers here, 1972 to 2012. Here is Hispanic, and this is everybody that speaks Spanish rather than just Mexicans, but this gives you an indication. So this is 40% participation in the workforce in 1972. It's about 30% the time that we're talking about. So we see it very steadily go up, the same as we see for white women, not quite as much, but almost coming equal to white women by 2012. Interesting, Hispanic men, Mexicans plus other Spanish speakers, have the highest rate of participation, sort of giving lie to this idea that Mexicans are lazy. So, and we'll look at the wage discrepancy later, which is significant. But that just gives you an indication that Mexican women were sort of becoming Americanized in the sense of deciding that being in the workforce was something that benefited their family, however they chose to do it, just as white women were deciding to do it. I wanted to note one, there's one interesting example that's given. This is not Historical Society, but one of the things I was reading. this idea of sort of resisting, and we always see this for immigrants. There's sort of some acceptance of Americanization, but certain pushback. You know, this is not where I want to go. And one young girl who was 16, her mother had become widowed, and the social workers attempted to break up the family. And the young girl said, you know, no, we can handle this ourselves. And the social workers wrote, this is from the social workers' report about the young girl, her impertinence and attitude was causing a great deal of trouble. She has too much influence over her mother and is uncooperative. According to this book, the social workers urged her school principal to give her a negative report, so to kind of encourage their efforts. But the school principal refused, because he liked her, apparently. So he refused to do that. And then they try to distract her by getting her involved in some recreational activities, sort of get her away from this. And she refused to do that and somehow managed to keep her family together, resisting this notion that was coming from the social workers that it was better to separate the family at this point. So another instance of women sort of showing strength, pushing back. So we see the beginning of activism. Sometimes with Mexicans, we think, oh, the United Farm Workers strike out in California in the early 1960s. United Farm Workers, established by Cesar Chavez, of course, have a boulevard named after him in St. Paul, but also Dolores Huerta. Together, they founded the United Farm Workers, who strike in 1962. But before that, in St. Paul, they decide to do urban renewal on the West Side Flats. We hear a lot about the Rondo area being erased for urban renewal. We don't hear as much about the West Side Flats. So all that area that now is being redeveloped, that flat area down at the bottom of the hill before you get to downtown, that used to be all a community. That was the Mexican community. The church is there still, but the explanation that was given, it was the flooding. There actually had not been any flooding for several years on the West Side. They'd been talking about the urban renewal way before the bad floods of the early 1950s. So urban renewal happens. The West Side Flats is essentially eliminated as a community at that time. And that is the beginning, what Mexican historians see as the beginning of activism in this particular area. It is, of course, influenced by what's going on in California and the activism of the farm workers in 1962. But we see institutions that are growing up in response to local conditions. La Clinica, which I believe is still going, a health center, one of these institutions, a people's center. Also the Brown Berets, which started elsewhere in the country, but are an organization of young people, including women, as you can see. This is not from St. Paul or Minneapolis, but gives you an example of the fact that there were both men and women involved, young men and women involved in this organization. Kind of a controversial organization. They were seen as gang members as opposed to people who were sort of policing the territory, keeping community members safe. It was a short-lived organization. And there are some pictures showing women, the women were members in very short skirts and really rather sexist attire, but apparently some of the chapters didn't go for that. So, but a young woman participated in that as a form of community activism as well. So we begin to see that in the 1960s. And then, if you can remember what we were talking about in terms of the feminist movement developing at that same time, we begin to see women of color, including Mexicanas, being interested in that movement. Not all of them, obviously, a relatively small percent ever become activists. But being interested in that movement and then being discouraged by that movement because their own particular needs are not being met. Black women had the same experience. So we begin to see some things. This is a groundbreaking book, This Bridge Called My Back, Women of Color Together, including Mexicans. But Gloria Anzaldúa, who just died this past year, one of the groundbreakers with that effort. And this other book is a more recent thing, Young Women Moving Along. So we've seen a tremendous development in terms of Chicana feminism since the 1970s. There's another organization that comes out of the University of Minnesota, Latinas Unidas, which is a national organization as well, which is about all Latinas, not just Mexicanas, but a leadership organization, essentially. So we begin to see those kinds of organizations grow, seemingly inspired by what's going on nationally with women, but also what's going on in the particular community. Obviously, you've got a long way to go. Here's the gender gap that I was talking to you about. This line is thinking, for every dollar that a white man makes, white men make overall, a Latina or Hispanic woman, which includes Mexican women, 54 cents. This is a recent, last couple years graph. So 54 cents. So we didn't even start there for white women way back when. So really appalling. White women, where are we with white women here? 78, or I think that's 78 here. These are all different women. Asian American women, interestingly, making more than white women on average. That has a lot to do with educational level. Percentage of people in poverty. We hear a lot about black Americans in poverty. We don't hear as much about Mexicans or Hispanics, Latinas in poverty. More women than men, obviously, but the rate is about 20-25%, which really, in a country with as much money as we have, really shocking for anybody. So got a long way to go with Mexicans, but I think the distinctive profile for Mexicans is that although they, in terms of their profile in the Midwest, they fit some of the characteristics of European Americans, but on the other hand, we don't see the assimilation, we don't see the movement to better jobs, to better wage rates that we see with other groups. So again, it's hard not to conclude that there's some sort of prejudice that is sustaining for Mexican Americans. And this is one of the Independence Day celebrations, that annual Mexican Independence Day celebration.
We've reached the Q&A with our audience at Merriam Park Library on November 5th, 2015. For maximum clarity, I've transcribed the questions and will read them. First up, an audience member recounts growing up as the child of migrant workers in Minnesota in the 1930s. Every spring, his family would leave Texas to work in the fields of Minnesota, and eventually his father secured a full-time job in the packing houses of St. Paul. Professor Zonizer compares these experiences with those of immigrants from other backgrounds.
But that back and forth brings up another way in which Mexicans didn't fit that profile of a lot of the other European American groups, in that you could go back. You know, if you came from Russia, you weren't going back, once you didn't have work for a few months. So there was that opportunity to go back, either to visit family in Texas or Mexico or wherever, and to go back and forth. You know, by the time we get into the 20th century, we not only have cars, which some Mexicans would not have had, but there are trains as well. So there was that possibility, making it easier not to be a permanent resident, at least until year-round work was found.
Next up, an audience member asked about the difference in economic fortunes, particularly wages, between immigrants from countries other than Mexico. How much were Irish or Italian women paid compared to their Mexican counterparts?
But the Irish and the Italians, I mean, you see Irish women and Italian women, you know, working for a few years, having enough money to go to night school, to get a job in a shop, or to get to even go to college. So you see within a relatively short time, those groups who are English speakers but also white, who are moving up second generation, third generation, you see that movement up to better jobs, to moving out into other parts of the city and then into the suburbs. But you do not see it, certainly for African Americans, which has been, you know, obviously talked about a lot, but also for Mexican Americans. You do not see that. Yeah, and the Irish were considered dogs, essentially. But, you know, within a generation, that passed. You know, when they were perceived, when they came here in great numbers in the late 19th century, when they were perceived also as taking jobs away, and you see these caricatures of Irish, you see it of Chinese as well, even though there weren't that many Chinese coming in the 19th century. But that perception, oh, you're taking my job away. But relatively quickly, there they are, they're policemen and police chiefs and you know, going to college and getting these sort of white collar jobs, but you really do not see it very much in terms of Mexicans and then people with a Latin background generally. So yeah, that's all you can conclude. It has something to do with the color of their skin and the various stereotypes that surround that.
Following that question, an audience member asked about the authenticity of Cinco de Mayo. Is this a holiday that is celebrated widely in Mexico?
Yeah, that seems to be the most consistent celebration, and I didn't have time to include it, but the Cinco de Mayo celebration, I understand, and maybe you can confirm this, is almost perceived as something that was almost foisted, in a sense, upon the community, and is more about making money. And if you've ever been to the Cinco de Mayo celebration, there's not a lot of Mexico there. So, it's about people, it's like the taste of Minnesota. It's about people coming, or the fair, coming and eating and whatever. So, but I understand that was kind of foisted on the community by businessmen, and essentially just to make a profit, rather than something that came out of, but of course the food has been very successful. Well, they're taking over eventually anyway.
The final question is about the Westside Flats neighborhood in St. Paul. When that neighborhood was torn down, were the residents given any sort of relocation assistance?
And I understand that a lot of people moved up just in up the hill a little bit, area that was called at that time Concord Terrace. And there was a lot of pushback from those people saying, well, we don't want these people from the flats coming up here. And that went back and forth for a while, and finally, some of them didn't move up there, but quite a few people did, just moved a little ways up the hill. And so it's always that NIMBY, not in my neighborhood. Yeah. So, some American history we can't be too proud of, but it's there. Well, thank you all so much for coming out tonight, and hopefully we'll do it again next year.
Yes.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. If you enjoyed this episode, consider supporting the Friends and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Visit thefriends.org for more information. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl and on Twitter @thefriends. To get the latest episode of this podcast delivered seamlessly to your mobile device, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Thank you again for listening.